So one under F was peace with a flaw, 1 Kings 9, 10 to 25. And if you recall what we discussed there, peace with a flaw, 9, 10 to 25, is the act of Solomon in giving those 20 cities. It's 9, verse 10 and following. Wait a minute, is that... In giving those cities to Hiram, and the question that that raises is, which we discussed in the last class hour, is did he really have any right to take part of the promised land? Part of the promised land that belonged to the tribe of Asher, you might say, in a technical sense, but which ultimately didn't belong either to Solomon or to Asher, but which belonged to the Lord. It was the Lord's land. Did he have any right to take that land and give it to a heathen king as collateral for a loan? Which is basically what he did. When you go back to the Sinai covenant, it emphasizes over and over that the land belongs to the Lord. And Israelites lived there, they worked there, but they could not just do with the land whatever they pleased. And in fact, there was the concern that the land not even be sold out of a family line, so that a family line within a tribe would keep its inheritance. And it's not Israel or Solomon or ultimately anyone that owned the land in the ultimate sense of the word. It was the Lord's land. And I think seen in that perspective, Solomon does something which really is not proper for the true covenantal king to do, to give away some of that land to a heathen king. So I think even in that act, you have an indication that this kingdom of peace is flawed. It's not perfect. It's not what it ought to be. It's only provisional. It's not the final realization of the kingdom of peace. And as long as that ultimate kingdom of peace, which I think Scripture tells us one day will come and will be established, but as long as that is not here, then there are going to be forced relocations of people, evictions of people, people compelled to give up their residences, things of that sort. I mean, history is full of that. And you had that at this point in Israel, where these towns were given over to a heathen ruler. You have it in recent Israeli history as well. And if you take that principle, which applies, I think, in a very physical sense, you might say, to the land of Canaan in the Old Testament period, but you take the principle involved there and apply the principle in the present time of the church, where God's people are not organized as a political entity with geographical, territorial rights or anything of that sort. But I think you have the same principle, in a sense, in the church. Even in the Church of Christ, where in a certain sense the peace of Christ is present and where it rules and reigns, certainly in the hearts of believers, and should reign and rule in relationships between believers, you find also their flaws and cracks. It's not perfect. To some people, that becomes so much of a stumbling block that they become disillusioned with the church. And some people even go so far as to conclude they don't want to have anything to do with the church because it's not perfect. And I think what you have to understand is that as long as sin still exists, whether you're in the Old Testament period, whether you're in the New Testament period, you don't have the perfect kingdom. And peace in its completeness and wholeness has not arrived and is not here. So So I think there's a balance needed as far as perspective to that kind of thing. I think you have to guard against idealistic expectations. In other words, we could wish and hope that everything was perfect here in this life and in this time. And people living in Solomon's time could have wished that that kingdom was perfect. It's not going to be perfect. And we shouldn't have idealistic expectations to expect it to be perfect. That's one side of the coin. The other side of it is we shouldn't become so cynical that evil things we see in the church or in society are simply accepted as things that we can't do anything about. And you sort of just ignore things because you realize things aren't perfect, and therefore when you see problems, when you see things that aren't right, you just tolerate it. You don't want to become cynical about things. I think that that latter position expects too little of the power of Christ and His Spirit. You can address problems. You can work for improvement. And there can be substantial improvement in situations. It's never going to be perfect. But there can be a measure of that. The idealistic thing that always looks for perfection doesn't take sufficient account of the fallen nature of man. I think you have to hold both those things in balance and perspective. And a Christian should have hope and expectations that in spite of sin, Christ is at work in the world and that things can be accomplished for good. And should work and strive to bring that about, but not be totally disillusioned when the results are not complete and final. Because they won't be until Christ Himself comes and establishes that perfect kingdom of peace, which Solomon didn't do and which no one else has done. Now, we're in this section that runs from verse 10 through 25, and we're speaking of peace with a flaw. Verses 15 and 16 give us almost a reverse situation. You read there, here is the account, we're in chapter 9. Here's the account of the forced labor King Solomon conscripted to build the Lord's temple, his own palace, the supporting terraces, the wall of Jerusalem, and Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer. And then you get a parenthetical statement in 16 after Gezer is mentioned, where it explains what Gezer is. Pharaoh, king of Egypt, had attacked and captured Gezer. He had set it on fire. He killed its Canaanite inhabitants and then gave it as a wedding gift to his daughter, Solomon's wife. And Solomon rebuilt Gezer. He fortified it. I mentioned something about Gezer, I think, back in chapter 3, but I believe it's 3:1, where it says in 3:1, Solomon made an alliance with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and married his daughter. I think I made a comment at that point that along with that marriage alliance, Solomon had received this town, Gezer. But you see, you have a reverse situation here. In the previous verses, Solomon gave away 20 cities. Here he receives one city. He gave away 20 cities to a heathen ruler. Now he receives a city, Gezer, from an Egyptian pharaoh. Gezer is also a city that belonged to the territory of the Promised Land. It belonged to the tribe of Ephraim. And during the conquest, you read in Joshua 10:33 that Gezer was defeated. Joshua 10:33 says, meanwhile, Horam, king of Gezer, came up to help Lachish, but Joshua defeated him and his army until no survivors were left. So Gezer had been defeated, but apparently the city wasn't destroyed and hadn't been settled and occupied by the Israelites. And apparently things remained that way all the way from the time of the conquest up to the time of Solomon. The city remained a Canaanite city. Now, you might tend to think, because of current events, that the Palestinian problem, so-called, in Israel, is a modern problem, a recent thing. But I think you can, on looking at the biblical text, say that Israel has almost always had a Palestinian problem in one form or another. And it existed in the Old Testament period as well, because just as today Arabs and Palestinians live in Jerusalem and other parts of Israel, particularly the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, so in Solomon's days, there were Jebusites in Jerusalem. There were Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, and Hivites in various parts of the land. Non-Israelites dwelling in the midst of Israel. And there were cities and areas where hardly any Israelites lived. They were occupied by these other peoples. And Gezer was one such city. From the time of the conquest up to the time of Solomon, was occupied by Canaanite inhabitants. So, I think you could say there was a Palestinian problem at that time as well. And that situation was also not just a political issue. It, of course, had political implications. But at its core, and far more importantly, I think, there was a religious issue involved, because the Old Testament tells us that the Canaanites who remained in the land would become a stumbling block to Israel to lead them astray after their heathen worship and heathen practices. And the idols of these people seemed to have a strong attraction for the Israelites. And through the period of the Judges, you read repeatedly that Israel went astray after the religious practices of these Canaanites. So the far greater than a political threat was the religious threat. Now, I think in Solomon's time, the political issue, as far as Gezer was concerned, was not that serious a one. But the religious aspect continued to be a threat. Not just with Gezer, but with other pockets of Canaanite inhabitants that were settled in the land. Now, the only way, really, to solve that was to do what the Lord had said when they entered into the land on the time of the conquest, and that was they were to destroy all these Canaanites and all these cities and their inhabitants. And if they didn't do that, then they would be led astray by their heathen religious practices. Now, the interesting thing is with Gezer, it was conquered and set on fire, and all its inhabitants were killed, but that wasn't done by the Israelites. It was done by the Egyptian Pharaoh, we read there in verse 16. So that action against Gezer had nothing to do with carrying out the command of the Lord to utilize this ban, as it's sometimes called, on the Canaanites. It was simply a military expedition by an Egyptian pharaoh, which was a rather common thing as these pharaohs marched up and down through the land of Canaan when they decided to do so. Undoubtedly, the booty that Pharaoh got from that city he took back with him to Egypt, and the ruins were left behind, and he gives the ruins, strange as that might seem, as a dowry to his daughter when she marries Solomon. And so Solomon sets about, as we read in this verse, to rebuild the city and fortify the city. And Queen of Sheba seems to have been attracted by this. She visited Solomon. She was overwhelmed by what she saw and heard. So you read in verse 9, her statement. She says, "Praise be to the Lord your God, who has delighted in you and placed you on the throne of Israel. Because of the Lord's eternal love for Israel, he has made you king to maintain justice and righteousness." It's a good statement. It seems she has good insight into what the purpose of kingship is. He has made you king to maintain justice and righteousness. Then you read, she gave the king 120 talents of gold, large quantities of spices, precious stones. It's often the case on state visits, there's an exchange of gifts. Tradition still goes on today. But it's in this connection that you get some comment about Solomon's wealth. You read in verse 13, Solomon gave the queen of Sheba all she desired and asked for, besides what he had given to her out of his royal bounty. Then she left and returned with her retinue to her own country. And then you read, the weight of gold that Solomon received yearly was 666 talents. Now, in the NIV Study Bible, there's a text note there that says that is about 25 tons. Not including the revenues from merchants and traders and from all the Arabian kings and the governors of the land. What do you do with this gold? King Solomon made 200 large shields of hammered gold. 600 bekas of gold went into each shield. Now, beka, that is about 7.5 pounds. The king put them in the palace of the forest of Lebanon. Then the king made a great throne inlaid with ivory, overlaid with fine gold. The throne had 6 steps on its back around the top, and both sides of the seat were armrests. I'll come back to that throne, but you go down a little bit further, verse 21. All King Solomon's goblets were gold. All the household articles in the palace of the forest of Lebanon were pure gold. Nothing was made of silver because silver was considered of little value in Solomon's day. Now, you see, in this context of this visit to the Queen of Sheba, you have these statements about Solomon's wealth. And I think in those statements, you perhaps can see something of a turning point. I think the wealth of Solomon generally is viewed as evidence of God's blessing. It's not something that per se is wrong. It's not criticized. But I think the question comes with what one does with his riches. How do you use it? Do you use them in a sensible way? To honor God? To advance his kingdom? Or do you use it for oneself? If you go back to Deuteronomy 17, the law of the king, there are three things in that law of the king, Deuteronomy 17, that a king of Israel was not to do. Three things he was not to do. He wasn't to acquire great numbers of horses. We've already seen that Solomon did that. Secondly, he was not to take many wives. Solomon did that. Third thing, he was not to accumulate large amounts of silver and gold. Now, I want to come back to the first two things as we go further, because they're mentioned as we go further. But here's the third thing. He was not to accumulate large amounts of silver and gold. When you read verses 14 through 25, it's clear that Solomon is doing exactly what the law of the king in Deuteronomy said he should not do. And I think when you look at what he was doing with the silver and the gold, you could say he's really not doing sensible things with his wealth. He makes 200 large and 300 small shields of gold to hang in his palace. It's decoration out of pure gold. All his goblets were gold. All his household articles were gold. Nothing of silver because it wasn't good enough. I think you might say, these are judgmental matters, but I think you might say for a king it might be appropriate to have a set of gold goblets for special occasions, something like that. But for ordinary household items, which seems to be what's talked up here, it's all solid gold. It seems like wealth is being used to build an image, to make an impression, to be like the other kings of the ancient world, with all the splendor of the court. And then you have the description of his throne that I said I want to come back to. He made this great throne inlaid with ivory, overlaid with fine gold. The throne had six steps. On its back was a rounded top. On both sides of the seat were armrests with a lion standing beside each of them. 12 lions stood on the six steps, one at either end of each step. Nothing like it had ever been made for any other kingdom. Must have been, you know, quite a throne. It was elevated by six steps, so he sits high above his subjects. The law of the king in Deuteronomy says the king was not to consider himself better than his brothers. And again, you wonder if Solomon's attitude here has not violated that requirement of Deuteronomy 17. Seems that the throne suggests that he views himself as above his people. There's an interesting textual variant with the phrase in verse 19, the throne had six steps, its back had a rounded top. Where it says its back had a rounded top, the Septuagint, that is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, says the throne had a calf's head on its back. The throne had a calf's head on its back. Now, it's not clear that that's to be a preferred reading. It's sometimes hard to know when you have differences between the Septuagint and the Hebrew text, which one contains the original preferred reading. But it's at least possible that here's an indication of a drift into idolatry in the creation of this throne. You know, when you get to chapter 11, the next chapter, verse 5, you read there, he followed Ashtaroth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. So you know that at some point in his reign, Solomon began to entertain ideas of worship of heathen deities. If he had a calf's head on his throne, that may be also some kind of symbol of idolatry that was incorporated right into his throne. Now, that's not clear, because that's based on a Septuagint reading, not on the Hebrew reading of the Masoretic text. But in any case, I think when you go through this chapter and you get this picture of the wealth, you compare that with the statements of Deuteronomy 17, which were to govern the conduct of the kings of Israel, I think it's clear, again, that Solomon is not the true covenantal king. And when you look for that ideal of the covenantal king, you do not find it in Solomon. You'll have to look somewhere else to the future. And I think ultimately, of course, you have to look to Christ. And of course, Scripture speaks of a throne in Revelation 22:1. Where you read, the angel showed me the river of the water of life as clear as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb down the middle of the great street of the city. On either side of the river stood the tree of life. Solomon's throne was not the throne of the true king, the true king of peace. Fell short of that. But then our expectation has to go forward to the fulfillment of that idea in Christ himself. Now, somebody had a question here a minute ago. A couple.
Yes. Yeah, if you are Solomon at that time, what would you do with the amount of gold and everything? I don't know. What should he do
with it? I think, you know, if you look at our society today, his society certainly would have been different, but I am certain that there would have been many useful ways in which he could have improved the life of his citizens of his kingdom by using those kinds of resources to do that, whether it was in education or whatever. I'm sure that there are a lot of needs among people that could have well been served, rather than for the king to exist in an ostentatious kind of display of wealth and luxury.
Is there any direct cities that show putting to the roof?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. As I said, that it's a matter of judgment. And here, there's no direct condemnation of Solomon for making gold shields and gold drinking cups. In this context, there isn't. But in Deuteronomy 17, we're told the king of Israel shall not multiply to himself silver and gold.
It's a shame also that much of that gold was stolen by
Pharaoh,
the next generation. Yeah.
Yeah.
Was just waiting to be taken by someone else.
And replaced with bronze shields. And it's Deuteronomy 17. It's 14 and following, but it's in verse 17. He must not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold. Deuteronomy
17:17.
You come in the Old Testament period. I don't think so. I don't know of a text that addresses that issue. In the New Testament period, I think it's quite clear that we are to help those who are in need. And we are to work and to earn in order that we may have to help those who have need.
But seeing that the people rebelled against it, too, it seems like the more and more it will work. If you would share a lot of that,
I think it was another question.
Have you ever prophesied that the one of the reasons that you feel like you're the reward?
Well, the kingdom was going to be divided because he turned away from the Lord. And I think that a lot of these kinds of things are evidences that he had turned away from the Lord. So there certainly is a relationship. But the basic issue is he wasn't obedient to what the Lord required of him as a true covenantal king. And because of that, the kingdom was going to be taken from him. One more question and we'll take a 10-minute break.
Yeah. About the Davidic covenant. And also this Patterson, he says Solomon represents the first stage of the fulfillment of the Davidic covenant.
Yes.
And the second, he foreshadows the coming son of a coming Jesus Christ as the true son of David.
Yes.
But I don't know how to analyze, you know, what to do.
Well, yeah, I think you see, I think the overall picture of Solomon's kingdom is a kingdom of peace, because everyone could sit under their own vine fig tree, as it says. There were not wars. There was prosperity. And at least early on in Solomon's reign, Solomon himself followed the Lord. And it was a time of great blessing. But things began to change and deteriorate. And I think that, you know, Solomon didn't come on the throne with all his wealth. He accumulated. It was a gradual process. And then he accumulated all these wives. Again, a gradual process. And eventually, the wives turned his heart away from the Lord and towards heathen worship. And so by the end of his reign, the Lord sends the prophet to say that I'm going to take the kingdom from you. And you'll only have one tribe left. And I think what you see on that is that, yes, Solomon is the initial son of David. And there's a picture in his reign of this kingdom of peace, but it's an imperfect one, it's a flawed one, which makes us then realize that ultimately we must look elsewhere for the complete realization of that.
Well, his election as a king was not by himself.
That's right.
He was chosen, he was chosen. And what it was the divine intervention through the prophet Micah,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And when he was intermarried with other women, the immediate curse was a plague over the Israel. And his coming curse was, destruction of the temple and the exile of the Israel. I think that was enough, for the his commission of sin, in the matter. But since he was chosen, and David, the king, said and promised, you will be enthroned in the afternoon. And then, and yet he, as you said, committed sin. But the result of his commission of sin was twofold. First, immediate curse, and the plague over Israel. But the distant curse was destruction of the temple at Jerusalem, and after that, exile of Israel.
Yeah. Well, ultimately, I don't know that the destruction of the temple and exile were all due to Solomon, because Israel had many chances after Solomon and many other kings. What page is that statement on? Syncretism began to display was a curse that plagued Israel through the years and ultimately led to the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. So I think what he's saying there is that what you find in Solomon, that is trying to combine the worship of the Lord with the worship of some of these heathen deities, that is something that continued to exist in Israel in king after king after king. It's not all that attributed to Solomon's cause that only led to the exile, but that the kind of thing Solomon did was also done by others down the line, many others. And in fact, that thing of syncretism is a thing right from the golden calf incident while they were still at Mount Sinai. They were attempting to worship the Lord through the golden calf. That was really syncretism back there. That principle of syncretism seems to be the fundamental problem, you might say, that Israel had all through her history. I think that's what he's saying. Okay? Let's take a 10-minute break. We're back at 14 after.
Yeah, did you look those up?
Yeah. I think it's built largely on infants.
Yeah.